Good afternoon to you. 4:07 here on News Talk 105.9 WMAL, where we are making sense of the news. Coming up 4:30, E.J. Antoni joins us. The Economist takes a look at these numbers the White House is crowing about today. Not all good news, though. E.J. will explain. Matt Schlapp is here at 5 o'clock, the head of the American Conservative Union. The guy is running CPAC today down in Dallas. We'll get an update from Texas with Matt Schlapp. And you can join us at 888-630-9625, 888-630-WMAL. Well, the Biden administration wasn't going to let the rest of the planet have all the fun. Yesterday, they announced that monkeypox is now a public health emergency here in the United States as well. Monkeypox. How many people has it killed? Well, zero in the United States. But it is a public health emergency, they say. How did it get that way? Who does it affect? Are we even allowed to talk about it? Those are all the questions we have for our next guest. It is Dr. Marty McCarry. He's a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and the Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. McCarry, great as always to speak with you, sir.
Good to be with you, Vince.
Monkeypox is a public health emergency, according to the United States government. Is that a sensible label for this? And what does that mean if you declare something a public health emergency?
Well, they're going to set up a monkeypox czar. They're going to mobilize some resources. It's going to give the FDA the ability to do emergency authorization. The irony is maybe we didn't need a monkeypox public health emergency if we would have contained it, but we made all the same mistakes we've made with Zika and Ebola and COVID, late testing. Remember, it was 3 weeks after the first case in the United States that the Biden administration and health agencies decided to mobilize the vaccine. Imagine if we had a vaccine for COVID before COVID hit us. That's basically the monkeypox situation.
And there has been vaccine available. And the United States, didn't we have a contract of some kind for many doses of the vaccine that would work perfectly well for monkeypox? And yet it's not in the United States because of bureaucratic incompetence.
Well, U.S. companies make money from not having manufacturing or warehousing in the United States, so we've let them get away with it. Remember, most health agencies are basically subsidiaries of Big Pharma. And there's also this interesting thing where you get 5 doses in a vial, but the FDA said you can't use that for 5 different people. You have to use 1 vial per person. So we wasted a lot of doses early on. We don't have enough. And it's ridiculous. We did it with COVID when the vaccine first came out. The FDA said you can't use the same vial multiple people. Well, we don't use the same needle. I don't know what they think. I mean, we know how to do this in medicine. So they just this week said they're reconsidering this multiple doses
yes.
for one person kind of thing.
The primary group of people that this affects are gay men. And the World Health Organization, other international organizations have not been shy about saying that. But in the United States, we are stupid. And so there's been this effort by the American press and by the Biden administration to downplay that feature of the most likely person to catch monkeypox. What do you make of this?
Well, that's the original sin of our public health officials. They've done it with COVID. They've done it with other infections. They try hard to let everyone know that they're at equal risk, and it doesn't represent the disproportionality of risk. You know, you couldn't say that it was more common among gay men, and not just gay men who have sex with other gay men who they don't know and do it frequently. You could not say that. So what we lost was any honing in on which subgroup of the United States needed that scarce vaccine supply.
Yes.
And where we should be doing the testing. And as a result, it's at large. We now have 7,000 cases and tens of thousands more.
And the motivation behind the silence on those details was supposedly to do it on behalf of gay men. It was like, well, we don't want to stigmatize people. We don't want to leave people with a bad impression of anyone because of their sexual preference. But wait a second. Don't you further imperil people by not telling them they're the most likely to catch a disease?
Well, sometimes they're not playing public health official. They're playing politician. So when they are out there saying, and I heard this week from our public health leaders, everybody is at risk of monkeypox. That's not true. It's not. If you're not jumping out of a plane, you're not at risk of landing without a parachute. And so we don't talk about behaviors. We don't talk about you know, prevention, and they sort of keep everybody happy by saying what they feel people need to hear. By the way, again, same thing with COVID. They were saying everybody's at equal risk. They had the same draconian lockdowns on everybody, and they ignored the 10,000-fold risk difference between an older person and a young, healthy kid.
Sure. But one of the differences between monkeypox and COVID was that in the early days of coronavirus and well into that pandemic, you had the government at all levels insisting that people needed to stay away from one another entirely. That not only do we have to limit certain activities, we needed to limit almost every activity. Stay in your home. You can't see your loved one. You can't go to school. You can't go to work. You need to test routinely. And now you've got another public health crisis in the form of monkeypox, and we're seeing no such guidance that looks like that. We're seeing reticence to even tell the most vulnerable people to monkeypox that they should cease engaging in the very activities that might cause them to catch monkeypox.
Look, I have no problems as a physician telling someone that it's not a good idea to have sex of any kind with anyone you don't know. I just don't think that's a good public health practice. And somehow that recommendation is now ancient, outdated, politically incorrect, but I think it's actually medically true. And so the question is, are we going to be honest with people? Are we going to skirt around the issues? Because you lose credibility. People are smart. They're not dumb. And they know what you're doing.
It's impossible. They constantly have the lowest regard for people. They say it's impossible to stop them from having sex with one another. Or what? The CDC has, this is actual guidance I'm about to read. And I'm gonna neuter it a little bit. I'm going to make it a little more PG for you because it's so insane. This is the CDC's guidance. They want gay men in particular to Jeffrey Toobin together at a distance of at least 6 feet without touching each other and without touching any rash. Remember to wash your hands, fetish gear, sex toys, and any fabrics, bedding, towels, clothing after having sex. They go on further. They say, consider having sex with your clothes on or covering areas where rash is present. I'm sorry. The contortions the CDC is putting itself through, this is just preposterous, Dr. McCary.
Well, I would, you know, instead tell people, or maybe in addition, that the largest study we have from Europe on monkeypox, of course, the CDC doesn't do this stuff, but the study that we have and the data that we have shows that nearly half of the cases are in people with HIV. So I would tell people, hey, if you're doing this behavior and you have HIV, you're at extremely high risk, okay? And those are the behaviors right now that is igniting this thing spreading across the country. It's also important for people to know no one's died from it. Now, we never wish it on anybody. It's miserable. It's painful. But people need to know the proportionality of the risk.
Well, how long, what's the course of this infection? If somebody were to catch monkeypox, how long does it last? And is there any other way for us to derive a sense of like, well, if we did actually stop people from having sex with strangers for, let's say, 2 weeks, would that solve a lot of the problem with monkeypox?
I'm sure it would be a factor. I think what we need to do is focus on education, and that's why we needed to know who's at risk, and we didn't for a long time because they were dancing around the risk groups.
Yeah.
Now, if folks are out there and they're engaging in these high-risk behaviors, they need to know a couple things. One, you need to look for that rash, specifically in the genital region, which is the hallmark feature, and it's not those bumps you see from the pictures on TV of folks in Africa. That's not what it looks like most of the time. It looks like a rash. And they should also know that if you get it or get exposed, let's say you get the early symptoms, you don't have the rash, you can still qualify for the vaccine because the severe symptoms and the rash sometimes are delayed. They're staggered and they come weeks later. So you can still sometimes qualify for the vaccine even though you just contracted it, which is why we need aggressive testing. So that's the message we should be getting out there,
yeah.
And it needs to be targeted.
What about surface transmission? Is it possible for monkeypox to be transmitted, say, on gym equipment or anything like that?
Yes. Well, it needs to be a lot of close contact. And so you can detect the monkeypox virus on, say, gym equipment or sheets in a hotel that are not washed. But in order to transmit it, we're really seeing that mode of transmission, prolonged, direct skin-to-skin contact. So for people who are not at risk of prolonged direct skin-to-skin contact with someone with risk factors, I don't think they should worry right now. Right now, we've got everyone in America right now texting, calling their doctors worried because we haven't been willing to say this is how it spreads. And look, 98% were among those who identify as gay or bisexual, but that means 2% were not, and they may be healthcare workers or people in close proximity,
yeah,
or people who engage in close intimate contact with those who do.
It's still, you know, regardless if we're in a monkeypox pandemic or not, or whatever we're calling this public health crisis, it's still worth wiping the bench down after you're done with it, regardless. That's a good practice.
It is. And D.C., just to, you know, make one more point, D.C. has the highest rate of monkeypox per capita in the country as of last week. So people should know it is circulating in the D.C. region.
It's wild. Lastly, before we let you go, Dr. McCary, I see that there are a number of doctors who've all gathered together, all people that you know, Dr. Bhattacharya, who we spoke with yesterday, Dr. Marty Kaldorf, Dr. Aaron Karadeh, and they've all gotten together to file suit against the federal government for basically using private industry, including the big tech companies, to censor speech throughout the pandemic, to make it only what the government approves and to remove the things the government disapproves of. What do you make of this effort by these scientists to try and open up public discourse around these health issues?
Well, these scientists are excellent scientists. I know them personally, and they were right for most of the pandemic. No one's been right 100%, but they were more right than anyone else.
Yes.
And they were mischaracterized. I mean, if you try to type in Wuhan lab leak during the first year of the pandemic, you couldn't find anything because, you know, Google was in cahoots with the government. So that, in my opinion, is a violation of the First Amendment. And so I think it's a good thing. It's a healthy process now to evaluate what we just did.
Yeah, I agree with you. Dr. Marty McCary, thank you as always. Really appreciate your expertise on all of these things.
Thanks, Vince.
Great to talk to you. How about that? Do you see the capital of not just the country, but of the monkeypox crisis? So we've achieved all sorts of things. Congratulations, Washington. You see this wild story, sad story. Four people, at first hospitalized, two of them have died of injuries that they sustained from being struck by lightning last night in Lafayette Park, right in front of the White House. And you see the video. There's, of course, you understand that there are all sorts of cameras that are pointed at the White House because the television news networks kind of maintain a steady shot over Lafayette Park going across the north lawn of the White House. So they can show the White House at any time on screen. Here's what it looks like there right now. And those cameras captured the moment those rapid fire lightning strikes hit in the same spot. I think by some count, there was like six strikes. Ba, 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 all hit at the same moment, going the same path. Shocking stuff. And you had local law enforcement and the United States Secret Service immediately respond to people who were wounded by that lightning strike. And two people died in it, a 76-year-old man and a 75-year-old woman, just visiting Washington, D.C. Here's Vito Maggiolo with the D.C. Fire and EMS laying out what happened.
Good evening. My name is Vito Maggiolo. I'm the Media Affairs Office for the District of Columbia Fire and EMS Department. At 6:52 p.m. this evening, D.C. Fire and EMS received a call for report of a lightning strike with multiple patients here in Lafayette Park. We responded with a number of units. Upon arrival, we found four patients, two adult males and two adult females. All four were suffering critical life-threatening injuries. We were able to quickly treat and transport those four individuals to area hospitals. With me are representatives from the Uniformed Division of the Secret Service and the United States Park Police. And what I want to do is thank them because their agents, their officers, witnessed this lightning strike and immediately began to render aid to the four victims, which is very critical in helping with survivability. I don't have any information on their conditions at this time, other than the fact that at the time they were taken to the hospital, they did have critical life-threatening injuries.
Man, according to the Washington Post, police identified the two who have died as Donna Mueller, 75 years old, and James Mueller, 76. They're a married couple. They're from Wisconsin. They were visiting Washington, D.C. as tourists, seeing the nation's capital. That storm last night, I was driving through it after our show was over. It came on us really fast, really fast. All of a sudden, you know, I went from, you know, clear skies to just curtains of rain and lightning everywhere. And of course, it hit really fast there, too, by the White House. A relative of the couple was reached Friday morning by the Washington Post and said that family members aren't yet prepared to talk about the two who died in depth. The Muellers were the parents of five adult children. They also had grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And they were in Washington just by themselves as tourists. And they had apparently no connection to the two other people who were injured, struck by that lightning under the tree. And some of the images you can see, that looks like one of the trees was split. May have been the route through which the lightning traveled to them. And that severe thunderstorm just nailing Washington, D.C. last night. The National Weather Service issued that warning, it came between 6:30 and 7:15 last night. And they were cautioning that there was very damaging wind gusts up to 60 miles per hour, as well as quarter-size hail. That lightning strike, which I said I thought it was about six strikes, that's what they say. An analyst for a group called Visala, they do a national lightning detection network. They said there was a, quote, six-stroke flash near the White House that hit the same point on the ground at 6:49 p.m. That would be six individual surges of electricity hitting the same exact point within half a second. And that is what we saw, apparently, that image of the camera pointing at the White House at the same moment hitting those four people. So just rough news for those families. Prayers for those families. And stay safe in these storms. You really, as soon as these things come on you got to get into a vehicle. You got to get out of them. Unfortunately, some people trapped in Lafayette Square yesterday, some Secret Service on it very quickly, but not soon enough to save those lives. Man, rough. All right, coming up, we've got joining us Dr. E.J. Antoni. He's going to dig into the economic numbers we hear today and the White House's reaction to them. Also, Matt Schlapp will join us at the top of the hour as we explore CPAC. He's coming to us from Texas. It's all ahead. Hey there, 435 News Talk 105.9 WMAL, where we are making sense of the news. Coming up, Matt Schlapp is here, 5 o'clock. We'll talk to him about CPAC, which he's running down in Dallas, Texas right now, and ask him, why are there so many CPACs? No, we'll ask him a lot of questions. Probably not that one. I'm not going to pick on him. You can join us at 888-630-9625, 888-630-WMAL. The jobs market, they say, added 528,000 jobs. The labor market, 528,000 jobs in July, beating the Dow Jones estimate of 258,000. The unemployment rate ticking down to 3.5%, below an estimate of 3.6%. Also, wage growth ticked up a little bit more than estimated, up 0.5% for the month. Now, all of that was being framed immediately this morning as very good news, and you'd love to hear at least some decent news about the direction of our economy. But what's the truth underneath all of these numbers? For that, we turn to our economist, an economist for the Heritage Foundation, Dr. E.J. Antoni. E.J., great to have you back with us, sir.
Vince, thank you, as always, for having me on.
The jobs report this morning, what do you make of it, sir?
You know, it's a really mixed bag, unfortunately. A lot of people don't realize, so this report is actually composed of two different surveys. One is a survey of businesses called the Establishment Survey, and the other is a survey of households. The Establishment Survey is where we get that top-line number, that 500,000 jobs added. But the Household Survey is where we get the unemployment rate from. But the Household Survey also gives us a jobs figure, and that was way less than the 500,000 jobs from the Establishment Survey. That came in at only 179,000. But there are a few other key points in there. For example, the Household Survey gives us data on the number of people who are working multiple jobs. That shot up. It also gives us data on unincorporated self-employed workers. So, you know, let's say I just have my own little business that I run. That fell 279,000 in July. And the reason I bring that up, and I think it's important, is because when those people lose their jobs being self-employed, maybe their private business goes under, and then they go and work for, let's say, a large corporation, they now get counted in the establishment survey. So we have a lot of mixed numbers in this report that, to me, indicate that the labor market is not anywhere near as robust as that headline number is making it appear.
So multiple jobs up, self-employment down. We also see these numbers suggesting that what we call labor force participation is down yet again. In other words, people have left the job market entirely. What do you make of that?
No, that's exactly right. That's been a really troubling trend of the last 18 months, where the labor force participation rate has remained stubbornly low. I think a lot of that probably has to do with things like removing work requirements from welfare that the Biden administration did. But the thing that honestly just made me so furious, and I'm going to do my best to remain calm here, was the statement that the White House had the audacity to release today, where just about everything in it was either untrue or had untruth.
Like what?
Untruths within it. So, for example, they say, oh, the unemployment rate, it's the lowest it's been in 50 years, 3.5%. Okay, that's true, but why did it drop? It's not because all of the people who were previously seeking jobs got them. It's because a lot of the people who were previously seeking jobs just left the labor force. You know, more people are working than at any point in American history, the statement says. Well, not if you look at the household survey. The household survey peaked back in March and hasn't returned to that level, let alone returning to pre-pandemic levels. You know, millions of families with the dignity and peace of mind that a paycheck provides. Are you kidding me? Are you talking about the paycheck that has shrunk more than 6% in just 18 months under your excuse for leadership? This is the result of my economic plan. Okay, that is probably actually the one thing true in this statement. Yes, these problems in the labor market are the result of the president's so-called economic plan.
In fact, I was sharing with Ed Morrissey a short while ago that you've got the White House Chief of Staff, Ron Klain, today crowing that the so-called American Rescue Plan, that $1.9 trillion package that Democrats signed into law in March of last year, that so many economists on both the right and the left blame for the rampant inflation, or at least a heavy chunk of it, that we're experiencing in the United States. He was crowing this morning that it's been great for jobs. The American Rescue Plan, boy, that thing has created so many jobs. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, that's certainly his opinion, and he's entitled to it. The problem is it just doesn't really stand up to the facts. If you look at, for example, average gains in monthly employment before and after that was passed and that money was spent, you find that the number of jobs added per month got cut on average by about half. So far from helping facilitate a recovery in the labor market, it has only helped delay it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. Okay, so there's another number inside the employment numbers that I'd love to explore, which is that it appears that women gained jobs in those employment figures, but men lost them, that fewer men have jobs now than they did last month?
No, that's exactly right. And another really interesting thing is with this household survey, not only do they break it down by sex, but they also have some components, not all, but some components that are broken down by race. And we actually found in the last month that Black unemployment went up and the number of Blacks with jobs went down. So, and one of the key things that you can tell that happened is because the White House was mum on that point. If we think back to just a few months ago, right, the White House was bragging about minority unemployment going down and minority employment rising, and yet they are somehow silent on it this month. Perhaps it's because it doesn't fit the narrative.
Well, and also, so there's two elements to the state of Black Americans and their job prospects. You've got unemployment rising among Black Americans. The White House does not want to admit this, not focusing on it at all today, doesn't want to highlight that fact, but that's true, as you've pointed out. The other is that labor force participation among especially Black men keeps going down. What's going on there?
You know, again, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that it is much easier today than when, for example, just 2 years ago or 3 years ago. It is much easier today to be on welfare and to receive these different expanded benefits without any kind of work requirements. And that really has nothing to do with race. It's true across races, right? But we are seeing that have a tremendous impact, in my opinion, on the labor market. Now, I think the other thing that's starting to happen now is inflation is getting really bad. For example, the credit card data just came out from the Federal Reserve this afternoon. We had a 16% jump in revolving credit. That would be things like credit cards in the month of June. So I think one of the things that is happening is that those who are able to work and are not able to be on welfare for various reasons are basically now scrambling to get work. And that probably is part of the reason why we're seeing that multiple job holder number go up by so much. People who are already working can't make ends meet and are having to go out and get that second or even third job.
This morning on places like CNN, there's a guy called John Harwood. He's nominally a White House correspondent, but he's really just a spokesman for the White House who works for CNN. And he was suggesting that the jobs numbers we saw today indicate that we are not in a recession, that that debate is now settled, that we are not in a recession because the jobs numbers looked like they did. How do you assess it?
You know, once again, when you actually take the number from the establishment survey and you adjust it for these different anomalies you're seeing in the household survey, what you find is that the number of jobs added may very well be closer to 150,000, not 500,000. Now, you may ask, well, if the establishment survey has so many jobs, why don't we just use the household survey? I mean, look, neither survey is perfect. They have different methodologies for different reasons, and it's important to try to get a holistic a view of these things and not just cherry pick a single positive data point, right? But at the end of the day, you can't argue with the fact that the same paycheck today, even the larger paycheck that you're receiving today, still buys you less in terms of goods and services than it did 18 months ago, than it did just 6 months ago. So the idea that somehow the consumer is thriving just doesn't stand up to the facts. People are now buying less. Look at what's happening with gasoline. Gasoline demand has fallen down to about where it was during the pandemic when no one was driving.
Is that so, that gas demand has fallen that far?
Yes. Now, gasoline demand does fluctuate quite a bit from week to week. So the fact that we've had one bad week or even two bad weeks in a row where the numbers really plummet, that's actually not all that out of the ordinary. But the fact remains that we have fallen tremendously when it comes to the energy markets. Why? Because people just can't afford it, right? We just talked about the credit card numbers. What about savings? Monthly savings are down 75% since Biden took office. I mean, people literally just cannot keep up with these price increases. And that's even with more jobs and with larger paychecks.
Savings are down 75%. Is that the number you just gave me?
That's right. So the amount of money that families have left over at the end of the month to save has dropped 75%.
Yes. And now we're seeing, so simultaneously, you're seeing that a record number of Americans are now living paycheck to paycheck. That's the reporting. There is also a dramatic uptick of the number of Americans who now buy their groceries at discount stores, in particular dollar stores. That number has grown a lot. Food banks are running short of food much more frequently. Now they're running out of food. They can't afford their needs as much, and that's a phenomenon that's happening nationwide. So when you see two quarters of a shrinking economy and all of the basic economic indicators that the poorest Americans are struggling even more than usual, that all adds up to a recession, right? I mean, when CNN says, well, these jobs numbers demonstrate we're not in a recession, that bears no resemblance to the reality that so many Americans are facing.
No, that's exactly right. And people misunderstand. They think that just because we're in a recession, everything has to be going in the wrong direction. That's simply not the case, right? These things take time. It takes time to get into a recession. It takes time to get out of a recession. Once you're in a recession, it's not like the very first positive piece of economic news that comes across the wires automatically washes everyone's hands of the situation and we can declare that we're in an expansion again. No, again, you need to take a holistic view of these things. And the fact remains that when you do that,
yes,
you see that by and large, the American people are worse off now than they were 6 months ago.
So the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ fell today in reaction to this news. In fact, this morning when the news first broke of what the jobs numbers were, the futures were down immediately. The market was not excited about these jobs numbers because they believe that this means that the Fed is going to keep raising interest rates and make it so it's much harder to get the easy money that they were getting in the past. Do I have all that right?
Right. So we're in one of those environments what some investors call good news is bad news, meaning that if the economy is actually doing worse, that means that the Fed is more likely to either cut rates or at least raise them more slowly.
Right.
And that allows this basically free money train to continue a little bit longer. But I think it just speaks to how dependent this economy and especially the market is upon either free or at least cheap credit. When you see that kind of reaction to good economic news.
Well, what it means is everyone knows what the Federal Reserve is trying to achieve, which is to drive unemployment up in order to bring inflation down. If fewer people have jobs and fewer people have disposable income, then there won't be as much money competing for all those goods that everybody needs to pay for.
That's exactly right. Now, of course, the real solution is not to take the money out of the American people's pocket. It's to take the money out of the government pocket, right? So that the government is not spending that money and to allow the people to spend it instead. And by the way, that is actually a really good point when it comes to this whole ridiculous so-called Inflation Reduction Act, right? This idea that we need to raise taxes because that will rein in inflation. Please explain to me how taking money out of people's pockets and giving it to the government is going to decrease the overall amount of money in the economy. It's not. All you're doing is simply playing a shell game where the money is changing hands.
Right. So the money supply doesn't actually go down. It goes up because they have hundreds of billions of dollars of new spending here, spending that they don't have tax revenue to support, which means that they're going to have to print that money courtesy of the Federal Reserve, and that only increases the money supply.
No, that's exactly right. And once again, another thing that a lot of people just don't realize, because our money is debt, as consumers now increasingly rely on debt to make it from paycheck to paycheck, you don't realize it, but when you take out a loan, I don't care if it's a credit card, a car loan, a mortgage, whatever, you are actually increasing the money supply. And so as things get worse and as the Fed creates unemployment by driving up rates and trying to make credit scarce, they may very well at this point inadvertently increase the money supply as consumers rely more and more on debt.
All right. Well, EJ and Tony, I really appreciate you helping us dig through these numbers. Every time we see these big economic reports, I think, what is EJ thinking? You come and you tell us. We really appreciate it, sir.
Vinny, thank you so much for having me, as always.
Okay, let's take a phone call here. Nick calling in from Huntingtown. He's on line two. Nick, good afternoon. You're on the Vince Colonnais Show.
Hey, good afternoon, Vince. Love the show. Appreciate what you do, and you do a great job.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Got a quick question for you. Maybe you can help me out here. Do you know if illegals are considered in the unemployment figures? Because Greg Abbott just said the other day that 5,000 illegals come across the Texas border every day. Now, I'm not talking about undocumented, the ones that, you know, are gotaways. I'm talking about the ones that they've had contact with, they've gone through ICE or CPB or whatever it is. You know, they've documented, and they've since Biden's been in office, there's been over 2 million illegals that have come in. I guarantee you not nearly one of them are getting a job.
Sure. Yeah, no, that's an important point. And one that's worth considering. I think that the obvious way that it would manifest itself is unemployment measures people who are looking for work but don't have jobs. So if jobs are filled and you have people who are out there who are looking for jobs but don't have them, then yes. I mean, in that way, they are displaced by the illegal immigrants who have taken jobs that otherwise American citizens could and would have. So you're right. That does have an impact on the economy. Clearly, this is a very basic point, even one that at one point Bernie Sanders, of all people, had recognized. He used to think that we should have a secure border because it hurts Americans and their prospects for getting jobs if foreign nationals can just illegally pour across the border and take them. But no, you're exactly right about that, Nick.
Yeah, like I said, to me, the numbers are skewed because there's all these people that are now unemployed, and they're not getting jobs. I mean, they may get illegal jobs, but they're not getting jobs. And when you say we got 598 or 528,000 jobs created, hey, that's great. Good. I'm glad people are back to work, you know, recovering from the pandemic. But that number needs to be skewed because they need to add or subtract the people that are here that aren't working.
You have the right instincts, Nick. It's always skepticism towards the official numbers, always, because they're always juiced to try and create a favorable impression of the government and how they're working for you when in fact they're just juicing the numbers. We see it with the Consumer Price Index, which measures inflation, all of it. It's always designed to conceal how much damage these people have done, which is why we dig in all the time. Coming up, Matt Schlapp joins us from CPAC down in Texas.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draftaccess to register for free entry today.